ancestor avocado, and 10,000 years after humans first domesticated the fruit, the man applied for a patent. He hired an artist to sketch his avocado from every angle, including the one most true to its original namesake, hanging from a tree like a drooping testicle. When it came time to name the variety that would become the world's most popular avocado, accounting for more than 80% of the global market, he didn't name it after his wife, Elizabeth, whom he was said to have met at a church picnic, or after his neighborhood of La Habra Heights in East Los Angeles, where the first seedling once grew. Lacking imagination more than vanity, he thought only to name it after himself, Rudolf Haas. To journey from Chile to Argentina meant crossing more than 150 miles of jungle and mountains while riding, much to Lathrop's disgust, atop the back of a mule. He had no desire to linger in the Andes. He wasn't above nights in the wild, although he enjoyed camping about as much as he enjoyed drinking cheap brandy. What worried him were the rumors. He heard the stories about gangs of thieves who rifled through travelers' bags while they slept. The guides who arranged the passage assured him protection, but he was wary of them, too. His posture and attire and the coif of his mustache betrayed his affluence. But having little choice, Lathrop packed with a deliberate notion of defense. He assembled his valuable letters and credentials in a small package, which he placed at the center of his trunk, tucked among his soiled laundry and hardcover English novels. To find it, someone would have to rummage through everything, and if that happened, he and Fairchild would be either tied up somewhere or dead. Fairchild, in his usual contrast to Lathrop's sour mood, was excited to cross the world's longest mountain range, whose peaks climbed 4 miles into the sky. As the party's mules trudged up narrow, rocky inclines, Fairchild held tight and took in the view of colossal condors that swung overhead. Their bodies, rotund and awkward, nearly 4 feet from head to tail, glided in careless arcs as they took advantage of wind patterns to stay aloft while peering down for prey. Fairchild's vertiginous fascination with the birds came partly from the coca leaves he had chewed, a remedy to distract the brain from reduced oxygen high above the sea. His mule slipped on a patch of ice at the edge of the trail, its front legs buckled, shifting the animal and its rider forward. Fairchild tensed as he slid. Lathrop yelled before he could find the words, but there was nothing anyone could do, least of all Lathrop, who had tied himself to his animal so he could avoid paying attention. Everyone watched Fairchild approach the 1,000-foot abyss. The animal kicked to regain its step. Then it kicked again. Fairchild grabbed at the mud, at the ice, but there was nothing to grip as he slid further. It was, he would later describe, a horrid moment of suspense. Fairchild lived, but no thanks to his efforts. The mule kicked a third time, a desperate last attempt, with such force that it would either fall to the side or stand up. In one motion, it found its footing and picked its body up. Fairchild rose with it. The moment had passed too quickly for Fairchild to comprehend such a swift and unmerciful end. No one talked for a full minute, silenced by the seriousness of the episode. The animals continued on, climbing and descending ridgelines and narrow trails, breathing heavily. Fairchild pulled his mule in from the unguarded edge. Eventually, Lathrop broke the silence with a stream of stories about his travels, his encounter with coca leaves, and the souvenirs he sent back home for the amusement of the Bohemian Club. The journey from Santiago to Buenos Aires had started on April 16, 1899, and would take 12 days. If it meant arriving alive, Fairchild was comfortable letting his companion talk until the end of the century. After crossing the Chilean Andes, the party entered Argentina and continued all the way to the Atlantic coast. Near Buenos Aires, Fairchild collected cuttings from a fast-growing and soft-wooded evergreen tree named Bella Sombra for its beautiful shadow. The cuttings from the tree would eventually make their way to California, where Bella would be cultivated as a shade tree. A more culinary discovery was a strange mountain papaya, no larger than a small plum, and amenable to temperatures below freezing. Years later, Fairchild would try to merge this papaya with a more tender species. Hybrids, he would conclude, were easier to imagine than to actually make. From Buenos Aires, he and Lathrop boarded a boat, Lathrop's choice, rather than prolong the discomforts of their overland journey, and steamed north, up the coast toward Brazil. It was dawn when they arrived at the mouth of Guanabara Bay. Low clouds hung over Sugarloaf Mountain, standing majestically above the city of Rio de Janeiro. For visitors to stay in Rio was verboten, not by law, but by taboo. To spend a night was to risk yellow fever, which permeated the low-lying city like a heavy mist. As the most dangerous times for parasite activity were dawn and dusk, Fairchild and Lathrop opted to stay at the United States Diplomatic Residence in Petropolis, a mountain municipality 42 miles to the north. To investigate plants in Rio's botanical garden, Fairchild had to ride a small cog railroad down the mountain, followed by a short boat ride to central Rio, a trip of nearly 4 hours. In an era when traveling across oceans took weeks, few people could be bothered by mere hours. But the commute restricted Fairchild's plant surveys to the hot midday after 10 a.m. At 4 p.m., the train would climb the mountain again and deliver its foreign passengers to their safe perch above the clouds. Fairchild managed to get his hands around just one species that interested him, a distinctive dwarf mango called Itamaraca. He described it in his notebook as flattened like a tomato and with a very delightful aroma and a golden color. Dozens of mangoes had already been sent to Washington, and hundreds more would follow. The competition was for the most reliable variety. The Itamaraca wasn't it. Notable for its small size and abundance on the branch, it would prove better as a backyard novelty than something that could support an entire industry. But Brazil wasn't a bust. One of Lathrop's cousins, who was living in the country, took Fairchild and Lathrop to Sao Paulo, where he promised to introduce them to the greatest coffee growers. Even in 1899, Fairchild knew that coffee was a futile fantasy for the United States. America had become the biggest customer of Brazil's coffee, which would have made acquiring the plant strategic, but Fairchild knew a rival industry would never sprout back home. No part of the United States could offer the warmth and humidity the coffee tree demands, which originated in the East African tropics of Ethiopia before migrating on colonial ships to balmy Brazil. Instead, Fairchild's final days in Brazil centered more on matters of diplomacy than diet. Around a large table in Sao Paulo, he listened as half a dozen men representing different governments discussed the politics of America's rise. The Spanish-American War, a victory for the United States, had ended the year before, bringing a pause to the fight over global hegemony. But those around the table had the suspicion that America's ascent was not yet complete. Things were changing, in some ways disconcertingly, revealing a decisive disruption of the world order. There, in the waning months of the final year of the 19th century, as red dust from coffee fields blew like powder through the air, the group of educated men of politics, diplomacy, and warfare talked long into the night, agreeing on little except that the next century would belong to the United States. Chapter 9. Grapes of a Venetian Monk. Barbara Lathrop had yet to recover fully from his bout with yellow fever. Aboard a ship that departed Brazil, his moans and complaints attracted the attention of a fellow passenger, and by the time the vessel pulled into harbor in London in June 1899, the man had persuaded Lathrop to head directly to Karlovy Vary, Czechoslovakia, for a treatment known as the alkaline sulfur water cure. Taken in a warm bath, the treatment was to drink alkaline water while fully stretched out to reduce stomach acidity. Lathrop became a crusty person when forced to consume anything he deemed distasteful, Fairchild recalled, but if it brought an end to the vomiting, Lathrop would oblige. Besides, the cure beat other rumored remedies, including one that called for repeated enemas of tea infused with cayenne pepper and petals of the flower lobelia. Fairchild had written off London and didn't care to stay long. He couldn't imagine any crop that, in several hundred years of colonial and political association, Great Britain hadn't already shared with America. What's more, the country was agriculturally unenviable, handicapped by a cool climate that was good for beans, tubers, and little else. But the short layover did yield one surprise. Late summer was peak season for Windsor broad beans, also known as fava beans, and at the market the day he and Lathrop left for Czechoslovakia, Fairchild deemed the oversized legumes, each as wide as an American quarter, suitable to send back. His package to Washington contained a handful of beans with explicit directions that they required a long, cool spring, like that in the Rockies or Adirondacks. A woman had offered him a puree of the bean, one of his early experiences with the delightful, salty mortar known as hummus. After Lathrop sipped alkaline water in Czechoslovakia, he and Fairchild journeyed to Venice. By now, he had learned that plants turned up in bizarre places, and there was no place more peculiar than Venice, a city built upon canals, whose tides took perfect turns flooding the city twice each day, leaving life so stunted and strange that the city's zoo had a single horse to allow children to know what an animal looked like. Venice's agricultural bounty was in its restaurants, where earlier food explorers had dropped delicacies from their worldly travels. Near the Bridge of Sighs, Fairchild watched gondolas haul monstrous squashes, onions, cauliflowers, and tomatoes to Venice's famed chefs. Taking in the scene, he raised his camera at the same moment several people lifted their eyes for the rare sight of a man taking a picture. Dining by himself one night amid boisterous shouts in Italian, Fairchild tried for the first time a curious stocky vegetable that resembled a small tree. Its crown was full and bumpy, and its young seeds, he noticed, were buried deep in the bushy branches, making them nearly impossible to extract and unlikely to survive the lengthy voyage back to America. But he paid the cafe's chef for a handful of them, along with a pile of sweet peppers and a flat squash he didn't like but tucked into his pockets anyway. The vegetable's name, he learned, was broccoli, pronounced with emphasis on its very last syllable. Broccoli turned out to be a cool-weather cousin of the cauliflower and cabbage. All three of them had their origins in northern Europe, benefiting from the frosty climate that Fairchild had dismissed. Ultimately, Fairchild wouldn't be the one credited with officially bringing broccoli to America. That would be his friend, Walter Swingle, who several months earlier in France had picked up a form of primitive pseudo-broccoli that consisted of more leaf than anything else, and shipped samples back with a note that it needed more extensive trial. Now that the childhood friends were both botanical explorers, Fairchild and Swingle exchanged postcards documenting their exotic travels. To bemuse each other, they attempted to write in the language of the country they were visiting. As both men moved around the globe, the postmarks were covered with a series of forwarding addresses, until eventually, the messages that had started as mysterious became indecipherable completely. In Venice, Fairchild wandered for days on his own, which offered, in addition to time to think and explore, the extra benefit of a break from the war brewing between Lathrop and Secretary Wilson. Lathrop's donations, measured in time, money, and plants, had so far been met with ungrateful silence by Wilson, who considered Lathrop eccentric. He blamed the millionaire for Fairchild's decision to leave the department to ramble around the world in a way that appeared to him haphazard and unfocused. In fact, Wilson's disappointment and anger at Fairchild were signs of how much he liked the young man. Wilson and Fairchild were both sons of the Midwest who came to Washington for important government work. Lathrop, by comparison, had only money, which he had not earned. Wilson feared Lathrop's swollen ego might rub off on Fairchild, an earnest young man corrupted by the haughtiness of luxury. Meanwhile, Lathrop acted as though Wilson's lack of respect caused him as much discomfort as his recent bout of fever. He grew upset each time he recalled that the secretary had refused to see him when he visited Washington to liberate Fairchild from the bureaucratic doldrums. In the months that followed, Lathrop had underwritten an entire government research program that required expensive travel for two. A thank you note would have been nice, or reimbursement for the purchase price of the plants, altogether $338.50, after 12 months in transit. Yet Lathrop had received no recognition, zero. He wrote a pointed letter to Washington, attention anyone at the USDA who might care. "It has puzzled me that no one in the department sent me a line of acknowledgement of services rendered, money expended, and plant shipped, to say nothing of any appreciation shown for the subsequent work expected of me." The letter, too, was met with silence. His resentment boiled over in Venice. After an informal accounting of his expenditures on nearly every continent, Lathrop angrily came to the conclusion that until Washington acknowledged his contribution, he would refuse to fund any more plant shipments. The decision threatened to kill the project. Discreetly, Fairchild wrote to Orator Cook at the control center of the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction, urging that someone, anyone, recognize Lathrop in some small way. Cook never responded, but several months later the department published its annual yearbook, which included a list of 450 new plants sent by Fairchild from the West Indies, South America, Europe, Asia, and the East Indies. Included in the official document was an unsubtle disclosure. "Through the generosity of Honorable Barbara Lathrop of Chicago, the Department of Agriculture has been made the recipient of a large collection of seeds and plants, some of the many importations of seeds and plants made through the efforts of Mr. Lathrop have already proved to be of decided value to the farmers of the United States. The warm thanks of the department are due to this public-spirited citizen." The shipments never actually stopped during Lathrop's tantrum, but they had appeared at the department unsigned, an indication that Fairchild had sent them behind the older man's back, on his own dime. After Lathrop's accolades had been published, however, the shipments returned to their regular size and frequency. Except now, in the usual note Fairchild wrote with each shipment detailing each crop and who'd picked it, he credited not just himself, but Lathrop, too. For 5 days, Fairchild wandered Venice's dark backstreets as visitors had for 100 years and would for 100 to come. Riding in a gondola that wound through the Grand Canal, he stared at the black smoke rising from chimneys and at the fresh flowers on the windowsills. As the tide rose, seawater from the canal lapped up onto Piazza San Marco, driving away the lazy pigeons. The rising water brought in slow-moving swirls of straw, eggshells, and cabbage stalks. A white-bearded monk at a Venetian monastery smiled with full teeth when Fairchild said he had come searching for plants. The monk escorted him to his small garden, barely bigger than a man lying down. Fairchild took his portrait in front of the only peach tree in Venice. As they spoke, the monk told him of a seedless grape variety not far away in Padua. Grapes weren't unusual in America, but seedless fruit was a growing fad. To be without seeds is to be sterile, and sterile plants can reproduce only by cloning. The seedless grape variety the monk spoke about would be a genetic replica of grapes grown by ancient Romans. Grapes were sweet and delicious, but being seedless held potential beyond a single fruit. Could the same method that produced the grape produce a seedless peach? A seedless lemon? A California horticulturist named Luther Burbank was pursuing answers to these exact questions. Fairchild would later meet Burbank, and not particularly like his mad scientist ramblings. But Burbank enjoyed the fantastic potential of tweaking genes. He imagined that a plum with no pit would be a delightful ball of juicy flesh. Fairchild hardly slept the night before he left Venice to track down the seedless grape. Due to Lathrop's status as a frequent traveler, Fairchild was able to secure a room in the Hotel Bauer Grunwald, a posh Venice guesthouse rumored to have once housed Marco Polo. Fairchild bedded in what he was told was the room the explorer once occupied, its ceiling so low he had to stoop when he stepped inside. Around 2 in the morning, he awoke to beautiful music that floated into the room like moonlight. Peering out the window, he watched the blackened outline of a man in a gondola, a flute extending from his face. To my delight, the gondola turned into the side canal almost directly under my window, Fairchild recalled. The musician was dressed in black from head to foot and was alone, except for the gondoliers. As he stared out the window, Fairchild considered his good fortune. On assignment for his government, for the second time in Italy, a land of glamour, charm, and grace. "Those moments," he wrote, of the minutes he spent looking out the window, "still live in memory as an exquisitely perfect experience." He watched the flute player pass beneath his window and float away, the music growing softer with distance, until all he could hear was the melody in his head. The first train left Venice at 7 in the morning, and by 10, Fairchild was knocking on the large metal door of a monastery in Padua. A monk answered, and after taking one look at Fairchild, summoned the head father, who explained in sharp staccato how to walk to a small nursery nearby. The man promised that a single vine flush with grapes would catch Fairchild's eye. He spotted it from several feet away, fluffed abundantly with rose-colored grapes, growing on a wooden garden arbor. The bunches, broad-shouldered and heavy with fruit, extended 16 inches to the ground. Fairchild placed a grape in his mouth to confirm the fruit's sterility, then another, and then a handful. Adding to the pleasantly sweet taste, the lack of pits lent itself to the convenience of volume. Seedless fruits had no seed for Fairchild to collect. Instead, he sliced the vine's stem diagonally and wiggled off several saplings, enough for a sample. He carried them in his pocket back to Venice, along, as was his custom, with a handful of fruit. Lathrop's face stayed motionless when Fairchild showed him the sticks, but his eyebrows rose at the sight of a half dozen purple pearls of sweetness. The older man smiled as he ate one. Before Fairchild could send them off to Washington, the cuttings needed 2 more days to sit in a rooting concoction that he received at the monastery. Preparing his shipment, Fairchild scrawled his impressions. "This grape should be given the most serious attention, both by raising growers and breeders of new varieties, as it has remarkable possibilities. That it has not become more generally known in Italy may be explained by the fact that no raisins to speak of are made in this part of the country, and the Italian vine grower is bound by tradition and will plant no new sorts. The Sultanina vines thrive in rich, sandy soil, receive only stable manure, resist drought very well, and are pruned and trimmed in the ordinary ways. An abundance of sunlight is required." The grape, of a variety known as Sultanina, would ultimately grow best in the wet and temperate soil of California, America's region most climatically similar to the Mediterranean. Fairchild's sample from Italy was the Sultanina rosea seedless raisin grape, which was a stronger specimen than a green Sultanina that had already made it to California as nursery stock. Regardless of who was first to lay eyes on the Sultanina, the variety took little time to grow into the most popular grape in America, adored by winemakers, raisin producers, and people who ate grapes by the fistful. Egypt was the birthplace of civilization, the first location where humans gathered under a central government and built some of the world's first cities. This led to dramatic advances, including written language, the wheel, and eventually, beer. People had never assembled like this before, and it was all because of farming. Farming in a group brought new efficiency and scale. When people worked together, they could dramatically increase their production of wheat, barley, and domesticated animals. Mesopotamia, the early civilization, thrived thanks to lush soil and overflowing water. This was assuring news for a plant hunter. Crops in Egypt had to be old, and to be old meant they were hardy. There would be no anomalies, only strong agricultural specimens, tested by time and chosen for their strength. Fairchild was as eager to see the place where farming was invented as a matador might find a pilgrimage to Spain. On October 31st, 1899, Fairchild and Lathrop registered at Shepherd's Hotel, a grand 6-story palace in Cairo that attracted deep-pocketed travelers from the United States, Europe, and Russia. The cream-colored building, boxy and modern with a luscious veranda that allowed diners and drinkers to peer down at the dusty street, was flanked with manicured gardens and palm fronds that pointed upward toward the symmetrical steeple, which was monogrammed with the hotel's initials, S.H., that were designed to look unsubtly like a dollar sign. Considered the greatest outpost in the world, Shepherd's was known among wealthy tourists as the place to see and be seen by the world's most interesting people, and to watch Eastern life on display. From the wicker tables covered with white tablecloths on the veranda, guests witnessed Egyptians ride donkeys so small that the riders' feet dragged on the road, and water vendors who hawked sips from bloated goatskin canteens. Turkish soldiers passed by in gold-embroidered uniforms, and dervishes strolled under large red headdresses. For once, Lathrop consented to a lengthy stay. Egypt was among the world's most fashionable destinations, a rare land that mixed ancient history with modern gusto, the midpoint where East met West. Lathrop couldn't deny the region's importance, even if he was still fatigued by his recent illness. If the goal of their odyssey was botanical discovery, the lessons of the Fertile Crescent couldn't be rushed. Unencumbered, Fairchild felt his curiosity piqued, not just by Egypt's crops, but by the roots of agriculture itself. Their expertise in farming also led to Egyptians being first to experiment with irrigation, and their system, which took advantage of slight slopes in the land, worked swimmingly. The biggest concern in farming, when will it rain, could be circumvented by digging basins that would fill when the Nile River overflowed. The basins, in turn, emptied into canals, which trickled the water on fields in a steady, consistent stream. Over thousands of years, this method yielded a multitude of crops, which now found their way to Fairchild. Someone offered him sesame seeds, which few Americans had ever seen. "The seed is used as a medicine," he wrote. "Put in water, soaked 8 to 10 hours, it becomes mucilaginous, and when sweetened to taste and with a small quantity of lime juice, it is said to be a refreshing drink." The same day, he made acquaintance with the chickpea, also known as the garbanzo, also known as the Egyptian pea. The red bean was roasted like a nut and tasted like popcorn. The Spanish used the garbanzo as a substitute for coffee, and a lucrative one. An Egyptian landowner reported to Fairchild that an area known as a fadan, roughly an acre, would yield a bumper profit of 20 American dollars every year. Fairchild built a stockpile of seeds, beans, and cuttings, along with notes, for an eventual shipment. Of all of Egypt's ancient crops, there was one that seemed new, and it was cotton. Over the country's 6,000-year history, Egypt had had little experience with the crop. It had originated sometime around 3000 BC in Pakistan, or perhaps Mexico. No one knew for sure. Upland cotton, the yellow-flowered relative of hibiscus, came to the United States in 1790, and by the 1820s, it had become America's most valuable export, thanks entirely to slave labor in the South. That, and Eli Whitney's creation of a machine called a cotton engine, a gin for short, that separated cotton fiber from seeds. Egypt only started planting cotton in its rich soil around 1800, but over the century, cotton alone would allow Egypt to grow from an economic infant into a global force. Its dynastic leader, Muhammad Ali, had been given cotton seeds by a Frenchman who promised they would yield a cash crop, easy to plant and cheap to harvest. He was right. After Ali died in 1849, his successors tried to grow the cotton industry bigger with loans from Europe, which taught the country's leaders lessons in foreign economics and debt. The next lucky thing to happen to Egypt was America's Civil War, which stalled American cotton exports. Distracted Americans meant Egyptian farmers could meet the global shortfall and become a major producer. In the 1840s, America had been exporting cotton to Egypt. A generation later, the direction reversed. With money pouring in, the new ruler of Egypt commissioned the construction of a railway throughout the country. It would be the most extensive in the world. He expanded the bounds of Alexandria, Egypt's port city on the Mediterranean. Even more bullish, he decided to turn Cairo into a culture capital by emulating another one, Paris. He widened the city and built a new neighborhood known as Paris on the Nile. It had large verandas, cafes with sidewalk seating, and Parisian-style buildings. Visitors to Cairo would be pleasantly surprised to find English bookshops and fashionable boutiques. The cotton boom built Cairo into not only an economic hub, but an intellectual one, attracting top minds to the renewed capital. And this would lead to innovation, the kind all developed countries enjoy once they figured out how to feed their people. In 1897, Egyptian farmers interbred a cotton from Georgia and a cotton from Peru to produce, as Fairchild noted, a variety with a long, very silky and crinkly fiber of a light brown color. This new cotton, he learned, was known as Janovich cotton. It was easy to grow, and its seeds were easy to reproduce, the perfect combination to satisfy recovering southern growers short on money and labor. The long fibers were so much softer and so easy to distinguish from the coarse cotton traditionally grown in the American South, that only a few years after its creation, Janovich cotton, which was neither native to Egypt nor there for very long, became known as Egyptian cotton, a name that grew to be global shorthand for exotic luxury. "If you think it's such a good thing, why don't you send more of it?" Lathrop asked one day, as Fairchild obsessed over the latest shipment he was preparing for Washington. It would be his biggest yet, and he deliberated how much of each crop to send. For a month, he built a mountain of seeds and cuttings, and then took 3 days to pack them with precision to ensure airflow, moisture, and minimal stress on the journey across the Atlantic. He knew what it was like to receive large shipments at the Department of Agriculture, and how well-curated seed parcels could languish if too big or confusing to unpack, as had been the case a few years prior when he had received a bulging package of Russian wheat seeds that died before able hands could plant it all. He packed and repacked again. The final parcel contained 43 types of crops, from cantaloupes to peppers to okra, his notes as colorful as the foods themselves. There were seeds of Egyptian pumpkins, superior both in amount of flesh and in sweetness. Cucumbers that ripened for the table 20 days earlier than the ordinary cucumber. And onions that he recommended for irrigated western lands. He included forms of beans, corn, and squash that he believed could outproduce native varieties in the United States. He took particular delight in the strange names. Names no one in his country had ever heard. There was a small seed called flax that produced oil. Grows in regions which are dry. There was red strawberry spinach. Gives a brilliant color to vegetable dishes. And something called the edible jute, whose leaves, when dried, could be turned into a thick, gluey soup. It forms a favorite dish of the Egyptian peasants, probably because of its cheapness. Finally, at the top, he placed seeds and samples of Egyptian cotton. Following Lathrop's advice, he sent 2 bushels of seed instead of 1, seed that on the open market would have cost an exorbitant $40 if a generous grower hadn't enjoyed Fairchild's charm and offered it for free. Both Fairchild and Lathrop were surprised when they learned the shipment would cost $100, the monthly salary of a well-paid American. Yet with this price came the guarantee the crate would arrive safely in Washington. Unlike shipments from non-English-speaking ports that would be transferred from ship to ship, some delayed by weather, others by indifference, Fairchild's shipment would sail directly from Cairo to New York, stopping only in Mediterranean ports to amass a bigger transatlantic haul. The investment turned out to be worth the price. Plant breeders in Washington had already begun experimenting with cotton, and their varieties were shipped west to California and Arizona, where growers had the optimal conditions, hot and damp, to build a new hub for high-quality cotton. Fairchild's cotton from Egypt was the best they'd ever seen. In Arizona, a man named A.J. Chandler was at the time working with cotton, trying to demonstrate whether it would grow well in the desert soil. Fairchild's shipment from Egypt supplemented Chandler's efforts, which proved more successful than he could have imagined. A new, long-grain variety raised the quality of American cotton and thus boosted demand in a growing market. One use for cotton particularly helped, lining the insides of automobile tires, which couldn't be made fast enough. Janovich cotton was the first of Fairchild's earliest finds to illustrate that the idea of plant exploration for the purpose of starting rival industries in America was economically valuable and geopolitically strategic. As cotton farmers in Arizona and California increased their output, Egypt's dominance waned. British buyers turned back to the United States, whose exporters were easier to deal with, and where large expanses of land allowed the price to stay low. Cotton, as with any crop, continued to evolve. The early Egyptian varieties transformed into new and hardier strains that grew more easily and reliably. By the time fighting began in the Second World War, Arizona's test plot of long-grain cotton had yielded $100 million industry, enough money to fuel the state, and enough cotton for every American to have a pair of breeches. From Shepherd's Hotel, Fairchild loaded his and Lathrop's trunks onto a camel and rode next to Lathrop to a waiting ship in the Gulf of Suez. As he watched the green hills of Egypt recede behind him, he pulsed with the confidence of a man hitting his stride, a feeling well suited for the work of a globe-trotting botanist. And he would be, for a time. In Egypt, however, Fairchild couldn't have known about the growing number of people back home who had begun to believe his work was unnecessary, even dangerous, and that the world, awash with new opportunity, was changing too fast. Chapter 10. Citrus Maxima. Fairchild stood in a Javanese market surrounded by oddities and trinkets as a woman strung his arms with bracelets and garters. He usually avoided these types of souvenir fairs, each an awkward chance to be ogled as a rich Westerner. Nor did he need kitschy junk to remember his travels. But here he was, every inch of his extremities covered with yarns and gold-plated bracelets, his pockets bulging with mirrors, beads, and patches of sparkling fabric. A crowd had gathered around him, murmuring with confusion and mockery. When the woman asked him if he was finished shopping, Fairchild looked around and pointed to two small cat statues. He gave the woman a few more coins and then slipped through the crowd, the figurines in his hands. It was impossible to know how many people he'd barter with, so he scooped up as many items as possible. The island tribes in the Indian Ocean had little exposure to anything from beyond their shores, which made strange, shiny objects a sort of currency to goad tribespeople into giving him plants. After leaving Egypt, the pair had steamed south and west aboard a luxury British steamer. So close to India, any ordinary traveler might have stopped in Bombay, a city in constant explosion. But Lathrop had no interest in the exceptional crowds, the filthiness, and the way culture burst at one's face. Fairchild might have protested if Lathrop hadn't promised he could visit India another day on his own, on Lathrop's dime. Lathrop also proposed that, instead of India, they steam quickly to Java and embark on a 40-day cruise of the Malay Islands, the same islands where Alfred Russel Wallace had come to discover the mechanism of evolution. This, he knew, Fairchild would not protest. While Fairchild shopped for items to trade, Lathrop handled the arrangements, which included visits to more than a dozen islands, many completely unexplored. The final stop would be Papua New Guinea, the bulky isle that had become Germany's early experiment in colonialism. The Netherlands India Steam Navigation Company had begun charter service through the islands, which was previously impossible due to unpredictable danger. Rumors of the islanders' bloodlust for white skin were easier to assume to be true than actually finding out for oneself, so they continued to circulate for decades. Even Lathrop, one of the 19th century's few cultural relativists, couldn't tell if the Steam Navigation Company had deemed the group of islands newly safe or simply profitable. Neither man was scared. Extreme wealth had a way of ensuring a measure of security. Yet still, American tourists weren't warmly welcomed anywhere in the Dutch East Indies except Java, a policy more to protect against encroachment than outright violence. Fairchild suspected the Dutch, sensed the unavoidable effects that have come from our towering pyramid of wealth which scatters over the world like locusts, or in other words, American travelers' reputation for snooty entitlement, and America's hot streak of taking over other people's colonies. He and Lathrop were technically researchers, not tourists, but still, when he had to talk to an official, Fairchild's words came out with the slightest tinge of an Italian accent. The small boat, long and slender, was perfect for the voyage ahead, able to slip narrowly between islands and pass over coral reefs. As it left Java, Fairchild drank in the blueness of the water and moistness of the air. Even though he had been to Java once before, the islands of the Java Sea enchanted him anew, a paradise of marvelous plant life, insects, and bizarre animals. These were the result of active volcanoes, which kept the already warm tropics in a perpetual hot bath that bred diversity in ways the mid-latitudes were too fickle to accommodate. There were coral atolls in the water and purple mountain peaks high above, all surrounded by a stretch of blue sea smoother than glass. Despite the danger ahead, he enjoyed thinking he knew the region well. It was an afterthought if Fairchild or Lathrop noticed that, as the boat left Java, the world inaugurated the 20th century. Early January of 1900 felt like any other time. The ship bobbed in every direction as it rose and fell between swells. Under the tropical sun, Fairchild and Lathrop were granted a pair of deck chairs and spent the first few days of the voyage giggling about a man they had met months before in Chile with the name Señor Izquierdo, or Mr. Left. They'd banter and colloquy, one as Mr. Left and the other Mr. Right, thoroughly confusing themselves until they'd slap their knees and double over laughing. Lombok was the first stop on the 40-day itinerary. Steep, volcanic hills arranged in a lazy horseshoe cast a shadow on the ship as it approached the shore. The Dutch had only recently pacified Lombok's people, then claimed the sooty volcanic soil as their own. Large cliffs and subpar farming conditions, except close to the shore where thirsty palm trees grew, meant there weren't many indigenous people to begin with, maybe a few hundred. Still, colonization hardly meant harmony, and so the indigenous lived apart from the Dutch in strict separation, both by custom and by choice. Fairchild returned to the ship with only a black-and-white lima bean and a new variety of peanut. The native market yielded little in the way of interesting plants, and altogether our days were a disappointment. He found the same on two more islands, Bali and Sulawesi, where he believed the wondrous tropical crops he had seen in Java were hiding deep in the island's interior, requiring weeks of travel that Fairchild didn't have, and a fearlessness of ornery islanders that he lacked. In Fairchild's diaries, notebooks, and memoirs, as in the writings of so many people in his day, there are frequent ruminations of this sort of racial insecurity, equating danger with things unknown or poorly understood. Many island civilizations at the time were indeed angry and violent to outsiders, but for reasons that were largely lost on Fairchild. As a white American of the 19th century, he had never known life with the indignities of colonization, and he couldn't comprehend what a formerly free people thought about being invaded by a foreign power. As a result, he frequently judged such unfamiliar people, even pitied them. At each place we met different types of natives who had grown up on their respective islands, knowing nothing of the world beyond the waves breaking on their white beaches, Fairchild asserted. The natives' knowledge of the world was, in fact, more complex than Fairchild realized. The people of these Indian Ocean islands understood they had been invaded by Europeans who had brought violence and disease and raped the island's women so frequently that babies began to appear with caramel skin. Contrary to Fairchild's opinion, the fact that the islanders didn't kill white visitors was a sign of the islanders' racial progress, a reluctant admission that they couldn't keep white men away with comparatively impotent weapons like arrows and knives. Even more racially aware was the way island people were resigned to their fate of colonial subservience, to the point that when a pair of American plant explorers dropped anchor, the group of native islanders, whose only possession was the island they stood on, wouldn't fight off the American visitors, but would humbly help them explore. The best example of this came at Seram Island. Off the eagle-shaped outcrop west of Papua New Guinea, the shallow sea, at low tide, moored the boat in soft sand a quarter mile from the beach. One by one, the island's men, bare-chested and with stained sarongs around their waists, sloshed through the water toward the ship, aware that fully clothed men on board wouldn't want their trousers dampened by the waves, and would rather be carried ashore. One had ugly red spots on his chest, and as he approached, Fairchild realized that the sickly-looking man would be, as he described the arrangement, my horse. As he rode toward the shore on the spotted man's back, silverfish jumped from the water around them and onto the thin pencil branches of mangroves. Fairchild, wearing long pants and a collared shirt, tried not to touch the man's skin, fearful it could convey the contagious ringworm fungus. When the man dropped his cargo on the firm sand, Fairchild gave him a nod. The sand around them was light brown and looked alive, moving toward the water and away from it, shells of hermit crabs scurrying from the waves. A dog with no hair other than a single knot of blonde on its head ran toward Fairchild, and right before the expected bite, the animal rubbed its face on Fairchild's leg. He laughed, and the island men did too. As he waited for the other men to be ferried ashore, Fairchild couldn't help but steal glances at the nearly naked brown bodies all around him, drowsy penises, sagging breasts, fickle clumps of hair. An American could grow up in those days without seeing a naked body unless in an artist studio. For a 30-year-old bachelor, gawking was less from deviance than from plain curiosity, excusable, in Fairchild's case, so long as he wasn't caught staring. 2,400 miles separated the beginning of the Java Sea voyage from the end, and within that distance were strewn thousands of islands, some a just swimmable distance apart. Proximity united the islands, but the people divided themselves. Fairchild remarked that the squabbling seemed childish and petty, a little like the feuds of poor whites of the Kentucky Mountains. Both are evidence of the insanity of mankind at this level of culture. On one island, several warriors escorted Fairchild to the home of their chief, where they showed him an old iron cannon that had been a conquest of a long-ago battle. The artillery didn't work without the powder to shoot it, but their enemies coveted it, and that alone gave it value. Farther along, the island of Dobo would offer the most vivid and tragic demonstration of violence. The boat that preceded Fairchild and Lathrop's had sent its engineer and bosun ashore to meet the Papuans and perhaps trade. But as soon as they touched the sand, a storm of arrows rained on them. The bosun managed to row away, but the engineer was stranded on the beach, and his sprint into the brush amounted to accidental suicide. The captain sent a second officer in official uniform to negotiate the engineer's rescue, but when arrows fell on his boat too, he turned back. If a military escort had been available, Fairchild might have made another attempt at the rescue. He knew that the military uniform of the prior man had looked threatening, and the best strategy would in fact be a slow approach, followed by exaggerated gestures to demonstrate that a white man's presence brought respect and not a threat, and that he considered the islanders equal partners in cultural dialogue. But any remnants of Fairchild's boyhood hubris had been replaced by the cultural wisdom that some people are not to be bothered, and so he didn't object when the captain announced they'd move along. The next day, at the island of Sekhar, a rock barely big enough to sustain 100 people, the situation was only slightly less fraught. As Fairchild prepared to board a rowboat to cross the pristine blue water toward the white sand, he noticed the scowls of the men standing on the shore. "Laugh," the captain told him. "Joke and do comic, ridiculous things. Don't look serious, or one of the ugly fellows may run a spear through you, too." Fairchild pulled the boat ashore. He maintained a permanent smile and held his arms in the air, looking a little like the clowns of his youth who had come to Kansas in the traveling circuses. He spoke in a high-pitched voice and opened his eyes as wide as they'd go. The Papuans stared at him unmoved. By 1900, they had become bored by the antics of white men, and especially by the mirrors and beads they brought as oddities. No one laughed, but no one killed Fairchild either. And when his act had gone on long enough in front of the Raja, the princely ruler of Sekhar, Fairchild said the only thing he could think of, that he was interested in plants. As he rowed the small boat away, next to him sat a citrus fruit shaped curiously like a pear and nearly the size of his head. The rotund fruit was green and obese, and on the inside, as everyone on board the ship would soon learn, pink and orange. It was a pomelo, known also as a shaddock, a citrus of such girth it commanded the scientific name Citrus Maxima, partly for its size and partly because of its reign as one of Earth's few original citrus ancestors. In many ways, though, the world had already moved on from the pomelo. Grapefruit orchards had sprouted in America, thanks to English colonizers who brought the fruit with them and grew it as a novelty in northern Florida, the only place where the climate was suitable. By 1885, Floridians had begun to ship grapefruit to Philadelphia and New York. Its popularity would rise, both in the United States and around the world, which made the pomelo, especially in 1900, rather old news. Still, Fairchild thought an original pomelo specimen could be valuable breed stock. There was also the value in a fruit so large and oblong it almost defied belief. And so, he felt lucky to have one, even if it required extra attention to ensure that his only specimen stay alive. Seeds of a large and very sour variety, he noted while the taste was still fresh in his memory. The seeds separated from the flesh easily. He placed them in a damp cloth and wrote a reminder to keep the cloth wet until he could pack them with soil, and after that, send them to the other side of the world. When the 40-day cruise of the Malay Islands ended, Fairchild turned his desires to the Philippines, which were newly relevant in 1900 because they were newly American. The people of the United States, empowered with victory over the Spanish in 1898, had developed a growing hunger for expansion. The spoils of war included the islands of Puerto Rico in the Caribbean, Guam in the Pacific, and the Philippines, a territory nearly as far from Washington as someone on Earth could possibly be. The Philippines belonged to the Spanish for so long, the very name for the islands had come from Spain's King Philip II, who, by 1898, had been dead for 300 years. Now, Manila was American territory, which seemed like a convenient stepping stone to the east and the 500 million Chinese who could become customers for American products. Rationalizing the ethics of something so nakedly self-serving, American politicians concocted elaborate explanations that it was America's obligation to maintain control of helpless Filipino people who couldn't uplift themselves, as President McKinley claimed. Albert Beveridge, an Indiana candidate for the United States Senate, argued that leaving the Filipinos to self-rule would be like giving a razor to a babe or giving a typewriter to an Eskimo. Rhetoric like Beveridge's did little to persuade Filipino insurgents that they should be grateful for American supervision. Instead, they swiftly turned their arms from their Spanish occupiers to their American ones, with even greater force. Filipinos escalated small battles into great acts of brutality. After an American soldier was found murdered with his stomach slit open, an American commander ordered the death of every Filipino in the village, over 1,000 people, according to a young soldier who wrote home relaying the story. Americans back home largely sat back and allowed the military to figure things out. There were opponents, and none more largely named than the deep-pocketed Andrew Carnegie, who offered to buy the islands from President McKinley for $20 million and set the Filipino people free. His offer was declined. When Secretary Wilson learned that Fairchild was in the region, he sent a letter asking him to survey the agricultural potential in the United States' newest colony. "An American military presence might work in your favor," Wilson wrote to Fairchild. Despite Fairchild's credentials as an American in an American territory, Wilson's speculation was wrong. The islands weren't mollified. Continued uprisings by Filipinos against the Americans had left Manila constantly on the edge of violence, leaving agriculture the furthest thing from anyone's mind. Fairchild's arrival coincided with monsoon season, which transformed roads into quagmires of mud. He managed to find some mango varieties on the outskirts of Manila that he thought people might appreciate in Florida. His instinct turned out to be sharp when the Carabao mango, as sweet as candy and not too fibrous, became known as the champagne mango in warm states that could grow it. Its slender body and buttery flesh shocked American taste buds that had never tasted anything so saccharine, aside from pure sugar. The mango left such an impression on growers and breeders that its genes found their way into almost every American mango variety for the next century, the stuff of plant breeding dreams. Fairchild, of course, was oblivious to this future success, another of his most significant contributions to American farmers. All he saw while visiting the Philippines was that Filipinos weren't ready for him. The pipe dream of pacifying the islands through agriculture turned futile when Fairchild learned that the Dutch had tried with coffee and the Spanish with farming equipment, and both efforts had ended in failure. On the ship that took them away from the hotbed of the Philippines and, for the first time, to mainland Asia, Fairchild sat to write Secretary Wilson. "The time is not yet ripe for any comprehensive agricultural survey of the Philippines, inasmuch as they are not yet sufficiently pacified," he wrote. "What would require at the present time a year to accomplish can be done later in less than a quarter of the time and at far less expense to the country. Any explorer who might be sent out from the department would be in constant danger, would find themselves blocked continually by the movements of the insurgents, and would be able to do very little in return for the outlay of money which would be necessary to maintain them." Fairchild's message was received in Washington and, through a series of emissaries, made it to the desk of President McKinley. If violent Filipinos couldn't be pacified with force, McKinley thought they might be tamed by democracy. After consulting Fairchild's report, McKinley sent a portly federal judge named William Howard Taft, a man oblivious about the Philippines, but with the legal know-how to set up a civilian government, wherein Filipinos could rule themselves, or at least hold the illusion that they were. Taft tried to calm people by offering protected markets for Filipino goods in the United States. But this had the effect of even further inflaming the Filipinos, insulted at faux generosity. Upon seeing the red-hot anger of the Filipino people, Fairchild believed that nothing short of the American military leaving the island country to itself would truly pacify its people. But his opinion was either never shared or never heard. From start to finish, America's costly entrenchment in the Philippines would last 48 years. There was nowhere to move, nowhere to step, nowhere even to look without catching someone's eye. People surrounded Fairchild's every latitude. Even getting on shore had required a series of minor collisions with other boats, in them men filling net bags with fish and wearing hats as pointed as their shouts. "One's most overwhelming sensation is of the unbelievable congestion of the mass of human beings," Fairchild thought upon arriving in Canton, China, on his first visit to the most populous country on Earth. For 40 centuries, China had gone through cycles of boom and bust, of economic rise and decline, births and deaths of religious sects and governments. The only thing that hadn't declined was its population, which seemed to rise daily with the sun until, in 1900, Chinese people accounted for almost one-third of all humanity. Such shoulder-to-shoulder volume had brought a sense of discipline and order, and Fairchild believed that such order would make seed collecting a breeze. So much about China was surprising to the senses. Chickens hung, often alive, under shop awnings. Smells of rice and seaweed wafted with the scent of steaming vegetables. The smell that wafted heaviest was of sewage, an overpowering stench to Fairchild, which men with large sticks across their backs carried in pairs of buckets. One shining example of China's ingenuity was in fertilization. No phosphorus was lost, not from humans or dogs or even from the excretions of silkworms. Human corpses, rich in nitrogen and phosphorus, were returned directly to the soil, buried under small mounds of dirt where the deceased had lived or died. This efficiency also extended to food. Butchers wasted no part of a sheep that could be used, down to its unwashed intestines. The only superfluous commodity in China was human energy, which existed in such wild abundance that it stood in the way of any innovation that might make people's lives easier. Backbreaking work carrying sewage or directing the cacophony of carts and animals provided jobs, and with those jobs, the guarantee of keeping people occupied. Luckily for Fairchild, the thickness of people seemed to be matched by the same thickness of crops.